On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization. Today's training was developed by the ITRC Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as a moderator. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the presentation over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document, Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization and Tool Selection. We're going to introduce you to this DOC guidance during today's training, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after the training class. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, or CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover. We are recording today's session. The trainers are going to control the slides today, and if you want to control your own slides, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where we started today. So if you go back to your reminder emails, you can access that. We do look for your questions and feedback. Throughout today's training class, you're welcome to type in questions or comments in the Q&A pod in the lower right. At the question and answer breaks, for people on the phone line, you do have the option to unmute your phone to ask questions out loud. At the end of the class, we do ask that everyone on the call fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback, not only to improve today's training class, but also as we develop new training classes. So many of the same people on today's call are going to be developing a new training class soon. So we do encourage you to fill out the feedback form. Let us know what we've done well. Let us know what we can improve on. And we can incorporate your feedback into upcoming training development. Another thing that you have available through the feedback form is to create a certificate of participation. So if that is something you would find useful, you can fill out the feedback form, be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended, and the system will create a certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the ITRC website, and I do encourage you to visit the website. We have new teams starting. This is our membership period where people often sign up for teams. It's a great time to look at the ITRC website. ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full version of the ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of documents available, many related to DNAPLs. We also have internet-based training schedule for all of 2017 set, so if you want to see what upcoming classes are coming along, you're welcome to visit the ITRC website. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers were members of the ITRC DNAPL Site Characterization Team. That team was led by Najee Akladis of Maine and Michael Smith of Vermont. Michael Smith is our first trainer today. He has worked for the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation in Montpelier as a hydrogeologist and technical expert since 1986. He manages the characterization and remediation of numerous hazardous sites, including chlorinated solvent sites, manufactured gas plants, industrial sites, and petroleum sites. Dr. Tamsin McBeth is a vice president at CDM Smith of Helena, Montana. She specializes in the development, demonstration, and application of innovative, cost-effective technologies for contaminated groundwater. Trevor King is a senior project manager and technology lead in Warrenton, Pennsylvania. His experience includes project management, developing conceptual site models in support of remedy selection, developing remedial objectives and site closure strategies for remediation projects, and regulatory and client interface. Jeremy Munson is a principal of innovation and optimization for Pinion Environmental in Lakewood, Colorado. He has experience in the design of site characterization and remediation plans using innovative, state-of-the-art methods. Dr. Heather Ritanis is a principal research scientist at Battelle in Madison, Wisconsin. She manages environmental restoration projects and serves as her section's bioremediation technical specialist. Her interests reside in technology transfer to integrate state of the science with field applications. On slide 6, I'll now turn the presentation over to Michael Smith at the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation. Michael?
Thanks. So I think I forgot how to change the slide. Great. I think we're all here because a lot of us have dealt with DNAPL sites. It's been a problem over the years. Some of these sites are 20 years old, 30 years old, and we're not achieving cleanup goals. We've been working on these for a long time. We spent a lot of money, many sites, many millions, and we still have substantial risk. And then some of the common site challenges we meet, we have an incomplete understanding of DNAPL sites. That's one of the problems. We haven't understood the complex matrix, both human and natural. We've had unrealistic remedial objectives, and the selective remedy is not working. Now, I'll start with a poll question, Juliana. Because some of these sites are so old, et cetera, can you give an idea of when did your cleanup activities begin? I mean, I have some that go back to 25 years ago. Or I'm not getting anybody's answers. 1988, there's one. 89. Okay, so yeah, 90s and 80s, it looks like. I have some newer ones, too, with lithium apples. 2003 here for someone, 2001. So you've been around a while. I guess we can close this now, Juliana, if you'd like. So let me get this to work. Okay, now here's some of the problems. We'll talk about this and why we've had problems on DNAPL sites. We've used some outdated characterization concepts. Back in the 60s and the 70s, even the 80s, when we started doing this, we sort of did the We defaulted to the Darcy law, Darcy generalizations, taste equations, which are really good for doing overall groundwater flow. They're very good for they're very safe for groundwater, for groundwater production, but they really do not allow a characterization to the level we need of geologic heterogeneity, and really don't understand true contaminant distribution. We don't understand characteristics of the behavior, and this approach has really limited our success. Because we've all had these problems. So our first, for our team, our first sort of way of looking at this was our integrated DNAPL site strategy. It wasn't just remediation. It really focused on conceptual site model, and with all IPRC documents, it has a flowchart. Now, my associated training next week should be worth going on to. Again, we really push, if you got to have a good conceptual site model, in order to do that, you have to understand the geology and the contaminants. So we added to this last couple of years ago, 2015, the integrated DNAPL site characterization document. And I should stress that this strategy is really not just for DNAPL sites. It will cover pretty much any site because it includes the dissolve phase, the DNAPL phase, and you can really apply this anywhere. But the really big benefit of the strategy is it allows you to get a much more accurate conceptual site model. It helps improving our predictability of the plume, and much more defensible knowledge of the distribution. So if you're in court or you're in a disagreement, you really understand where the contaminants are. It facilitates communication. We've found this, again, to help a lot with stakeholders and with problem holders. We know what we're looking at, so we can actually communicate much better. It reduces uncertainty. If people are concerned about risk, you really want to have your uncertainty reduced. And we really have seen better performing remedies. Some of the key concepts we're approaching were incorporated in this characterization strategy. The first one is heterogeneity replaces homogeneity. We're going to talk a lot more about these later on, but basically we're looking at the geologic variations in the subsurface as controlling a lot of the contaminant flow. Same with heterogeneity. It's also anisotropy replaces isotropy. Those are assumptions. Homogeneity and isotropy are assumptions in the Darcy equations and taste equations, but realize they really don't fit for contaminant flow. Diffusion replaces dispersion. What we're finding, and the next one is back diffusion, is a significant source of contamination and plume growth. What we're finding is, because of the heterogeneities in geology, we really don't have dispersion of contaminants that were predicted back in the 80s. We're really finding that the contaminants are in smaller channels, smaller preferential pathways, and then they're diffusing into the finer grain materials around them, which then back diffuses. It's also a non-Gaussian distribution if you want to try any statistics. It's definitely not normally distributed. Transient replaces steady state. So it is always changing, it's always evolving. Nonlinear replaces linear sorption, and non-ideal sorption replaces ideal sorption. Doesn't follow the original rules, so you have to really look at it and, again, understand the geology. And after this training, we hope you'll be able to, one, apply this document and to support an integrated DNAPL characterization approach. I think it's written that it's pretty doable to follow. understand what characteristics of site conditions must be considered when developing this model. We really harp on that in the documents. You really have to understand the site conditions and the contaminant. Defining an integrated DNAP characterization strategy. Again, it goes back to this loop. Understand the contamination, understand the site characteristics, and then you can get a good characterization strategy to help you do that. Understand what tools and resources are available. We provide quite a bit of tools in the document. We have a table which helps you find which tools you can use. We have a lot of references, and we have some really good information. You'll be able to navigate that tools table to select appropriate technologies. We have even picture chemistry, hydrogeology tools, geology tools, and really, again, it's a very big help. But if nothing else, we'll stress this a lot, and I always stress this. If you gain nothing else, understand the geology controls DNAP, and I should say dissolved phase contaminant mobility too. If you look at that picture, there's very small distances, big changes in the geology. If you start looking at the numbers, you'll see huge differences in hydraulic conductivity. The heterogeneity leads to differences in the pore structure and capillary properties, which affect how it flows. There's really significant variations over small intervals. And NAPO migration, if you've done this, is really strongly influenced by the topography of geologic layers. A very small change in permeability can actually create a confining layer for sense for the contamination to stick on, or can actually make a pathway for it to flow through. So right now I'm going to turn this over to Tamsin McBeth. Tamsin?
Thank you, Michael. So as Mike was saying, you know, one of the key things that our team came to is that really it's important to kind of go back and really understand the properties of the contaminants and the DNAPLs in particular, as well as the systems that we're working in, these heterogeneous subsurface environments. So what we're going to do now is switch gears and kind of go over some basics, some understanding about subsurface behavior of DNAPLs, how DNAPLs migrate, what their characteristics are. We won't go into a lot of depth, but we want to make sure that you have the foundation to really understand why these chemicals behave the way that they do in the subsurface and how that then translates into what we call the life cycle of a DNAPL site, which is going to be the next step. So we're going to go through some fundamentals, and as Mike said, you know, we're highlighting DNAPLs here, but you can really evaluate a variety of contaminant classes. And in addition, when we talk about DNAPLs, we very frequently are really focused on chlorinated solvents because they're very prevalent, and a lot of us within the industry are dealing with these chemicals. But really, there's a variety of different types of DNAPLs, as is shown in this photograph. You know, we have our kind of standard chlorinated solvents like PCE in a soil core. You can see the DNAPL. This is actually a soil core from a site I worked on, and it had almost pure phase PCE, you know, that would be delivered to like a dry cleaner site, and you can see the DNAPL globules, if you will. But it also includes things like coal tars, and you can see in the second photo you have a soil core that's highly contaminated with saturated DNAPL coal tar. But it can also include a variety of other things like motor oils, heavy hydrocarbons. The third picture has this mixture of heavy hydrocarbons, bunker fuels, aryl phosphates, which are flame retardants, things like PCBs. You know, all of these kind of mixed contaminants can behave as DNAPLs. So some common types of DNAPLs, again, and really we overview this in Chapter 2 of the document in detail, so definitely refer to the document. But these are the different types of DNAPLs, and the type really controls how they distribute in the subsurface and their fate within that subsurface environment. So we've got our typical, again, chlorinated solvents, but again, we also have coal tars, creosotes, heavy hydrocarbons, PCBs, you know, all of these things that can be either in single phase or very often are mixed phases. Things like hydrocarbon and chlorinated solvent mixtures are something we often come across, and those mixtures can affect the properties of those DNAPLs. So, Juliana, we want to gauge what
types of DNAPLs are you all working on at your sites? Chlorinated solvents, coal tars, we have folks working on PCBs, pesticides, mercury. So yeah, this is a very sort of typical mix, if you will, where we've got a lot of folks, you know, 84% working on chlorinated solvent sites. Go ahead and just check all that apply. We've got about 20% of folks working on coal tar sites, some creosote sites, lots of folks working on petroleum, heavy petroleum hydrocarbon sites, PCB sites, pesticides. We have some folks working at mercury sites. That's kind of unusual. And then we have some others. So there's some other interesting mixes of these DNAPL chemicals that people are needing to address and develop remedial programs for. So this is a very kind of common distribution, I would say. So Juliana, we could probably go ahead and close the poll. Thank you. So one of the things that is important, and now that we understand there's a whole variety of chemicals that we're dealing with, is that it's really important to understand the chemical that you're dealing with at a particular site. So really it's important to understand the chemical and the physical properties of that DNAPL. And first we're going to kind of look at the DNAPL itself and how these properties affect mobility. So we're just going to briefly go through some basic properties like density, solubility, viscosity, volatility, and composition. So DNAPL density is one of the more important characteristics of DNAPLs because, of course, this is what makes a DNAPL a DNAPL. It's the D, it's density. It's a dense non-aqueous phase liquid. And what that means is that density is the mass per unit volume, and it's often expressed in terms of specific gravity, which is the density relative to water. So a DNAPL, by definition, has a specific gravity greater than one or greater than water. And that's important because when we're trying to understand how these DNAPLs behave in aquifer environments, in these saturated water systems, what happens is they sink because they're dense. So that sinking characteristic and how they sink, how fast they sink, is important when we're trying to understand what volumes of a subsurface environment they impact. So in this case, DNAPLs, the key point here is really these gravitational forces. Gravity is what determines largely how DNAPLs migrate in subsurface environments, not advection or advective flow in groundwater. So that's important. Next is the DNAPL aqueous solubility. So this is really the amount of that chemical that's dissolving in the water system at equilibrium. And very often, we're dealing with different types of DNAPLs that might have vastly different solubility. So this really describes and controls how this chemical mass is loading from the DNAPL into the aqueous phase, how it's loading that mass into the groundwater plume. If you have something like TCE here, we've got a density property there. The solubility is somewhere between 11 and 1300 milligrams per liter. You can have very insoluble things like pentachlorophenol at 20 milligrams per liter, or things that are, for all intents and purposes, almost completely miscible, like acid tars. And that means that as soon as they hit water, they almost completely dissolve out. So how quickly mass loads from these DNAPLs into groundwater affects the longevity of the DNAPL. It also affects the intensity or the concentrations within the plume, and it affects how large that plume is going to get over time. So next we have DNAPL viscosity, and in particular dynamic viscosity, and this represents the thickness or the resistance to shear flow of the fluid. And one of the examples I always like to use is really the example of honey and water. The difference between the two is this viscosity term, where the honey is more viscous than water, water is more viscous than air, and this viscosity affects the rate at which DNAPLs migrate in the subsurface. It essentially describes how sticky they are, if you will, just like honey. So it doesn't necessarily inherently influence whether or not a DNAPL can migrate. Sort of influences how that DNAPL interacts with the soil matrix that it's migrating within. And if you have something like a coal tar, for instance, which has a very high viscosity, that coal tar often will not migrate as deep as something like a chlorinated solvent because of the high viscosity. And this is also a property that is often manipulated from an engineering sense when we look at remediation technologies, and in particular because it's temperature dependent. And so in this case, we have three different types of coal tar, which again have a very high viscosity, but you can see that that viscosity declines as a function of temperature. As you go from, say, a standard groundwater temperature of 20 degrees C to 50 degrees C. So often, if we're trying to engineer an extraction system to extract that DNAPL, if you increase the temperature, it can reduce the viscosity and make the DNAPL more likely to be mobile. So again, viscosity affects the mobility of the DNAPL. Volatility is another important characteristic, and it really represents the tendency of the DNAPL constituents to evaporate into the vapor phase. So the volatility is generally measured by vapor pressure, and it affects the partitioning or the transfer of chemicals from either the DNAPL into the vapor phase or potentially even from the groundwater plume into the vapor phase. And so this is really what controls often the amount of mass that loads into the VADO zone from these different sources, either the DNAPL source or from the groundwater plume, and affects things like vapor intrusion. So the other important characteristic is that when you have mixtures of DNAPLs, that also affects the vapor pressures, and so you have to ensure or assure that you understand the mixtures of chemicals to accurately describe how much of that chemical is going to load into the VADO zone. We don't talk a lot about vapor intrusion, but ITRC does have a vapor intrusion pathway guidance, which you should refer to, that provides a lot more information. And so again, this really affects or drives the amount of mass that's lost or that is mobilized or discharged into the vapor phase or VADO zone. So as I alluded to previously, DNAPL composition can be really important because all of these properties, density, viscosity, volatility, are changed when you go from having a pure phase of the chemical to mixtures of the chemical. We know that very often we have sites where you had multiple types of releases, where you might have mixtures of, say, chlorinated solvents or other chemicals such as grease, oils, hydrocarbons, diesel fuels. And so those mixtures really affect how that DNAPL behaves in the subsurface, whether it behaves as a light DNAPL or a dense DNAPL, how it migrates vertically, how it dissolves into the groundwater plume, how it volatilizes in the vapor phase. And so the key point here really is just that you need to ensure that you have analyses of all of these chemical and physical properties for the DNAPL at your site, because especially if you have mixtures, all of these properties can be different. And very often, assuming, say, a pure TCE and using the properties in the design calculations or the fate and transport calculations can misinform your conceptual site model. So now that we've gone through some basic characteristics of DNAPLs, we're going to talk about the characteristics of a DNAPL within the subsurface system and how those characteristics affect the mobility of that DNAPL. And that includes things like interfacial tension, wettability, capillary pressure, saturation, and residual saturation. So these are all the kind of combined characteristics of the DNAPL and the specific geologic media that that DNAPL is present in. So first we're going to talk about interfacial tension and wettability. Wettability really represents whether a fluid is wicked into or repelled out of a subsurface media. And it's defined by the contact angle of the DNAPL fluid against these matrix, you know, soil or sediment materials in the presence of water. Generally, wettability is a combined property of the DNAPL and, again, and that subsurface formation that that DNAPL is in. And it can be affected by chemistry and the presence of other sort of co-contaminants, if you will. So these adhesive forces between the liquid and the solid can cause a drop to separate across the surface. So you can see here you have a drop, and it really is that angle and the way that it spreads across the surface that determines how much of that liquid is going to stick to that surface. So this really defines or helps define whether or not you're going to, what that solubility is of the chemical and how that chemical adheres onto that solid matrix. Interfacial tension represents the force parallel to the interface from one fluid with another fluid, like air or water and DNAPL. And this leads to the formation of a meniscus and the development of capillary forces and pressure between those different fluids. So these, all these properties, this interfacial tension, the viscosity, wettability, capillary pressure, all affect how that DNAPL is going to migrate and whether it's going to migrate within an aquifer system. And so in particular, when we look at the propensity of a DNAPL to migrate into the saturated zone, into the aquifer, that really is dictated largely by capillary pressure. And this capillary pressure represents the pressure differences between the two fluids sharing this pore space. So in this case, the DNAPL and the water. And due to interfacial tension and that meniscus, the non-wetting fluid, which is generally the DNAPL or the DNAPL, develops a greater pressure than the wetting fluid, which is generally groundwater. And so this capillary pressure is a nonlinear function of saturation, and we'll talk about that in a minute. With the capillary pressure increasing at greater saturation. So as that DNAPL sort of sits at the interface of and within the groundwater system, this really determines and it accumulates or it builds up, the higher the saturation, the greater this pressure difference between the DNAPL and the water, and that pressure, that threshold pressure, is what determines whether that DNAPL is going to or overcome that capillary pressure and migrate vertically into that pore space or not. So the other thing that's important with this capillary pressure is not just the properties of the DNAPL in the water, but this variability in the pore spaces of the geologic media, or if you're dealing with a sand or a gravel or a silt, and those tighter pore throats, the silts, you know, or the clays, really require much higher capillary pressures for that DNAPL to have to overcome to migrate vertically. So that's where this geology component really becomes very important. And like Mike said, this heterogeneity, because even very small differences in these pore throat sizes, as you transition from a sand to a silt, those interfaces is really where the DNAPLs likely migrate and likely tend to accumulate. So that's exemplified in this example. This is from a Bernie Cooper et al. Example in the Illustrated Handbook of DNAPL Transport Fate in the Subsurface. And this really kind of highlights how the different geologic properties, where you have silts and sands and medium sands and coarse sands, how those affect the thickness, if you will, of a DNAPL pool that will accumulate on top of those different geologic media. So you've got the media on the x-axis. You have different types of DNAPLs. We've got a creosote in pink, a coal tar in blue, chlorinated solvent in yellow, and a mixed DNAPL in green. So you can look at how thick or how much DNAPL is going to accumulate onto these different silts, fine sands, medium sands, and coarse sands. And you can see here that the really viscous creosote and coal tars overall tend to accumulate in thicker pool heights in all of the media, but that the finer the media, the thicker that DNAPL will accumulate before it will migrate through. And so here you can see how, in this case, the lower viscosity chlorinated solvents or this mixed DNAPL really tend to form smaller pool heights on top of those interfaces. But overall, which means those chemicals are more readily migrating through all these geologic media compared to your thicker, more viscous NAPLs. So this really just exemplifies, again, this relationship between both the geologic media and the DNAPL in terms of determining whether that DNAPL is going to migrate through that geologic or stratigraphic layer, or it's going to tend to sort of accumulate and sit on top of it. The other important characteristic that I alluded to is really this DNAPL saturation. And this is a characteristic that describes the proportion of the subsurface pore space that's occupied by a fluid, so either the DNAPL, air, or water, and it ranges from 0 to 1. And when you have multiple fluids that are present, like a DNAPL and water in a saturated system, the sum of those fluid saturations equals 1. So what we very often use is this concept of a DNAPL saturation. And in general, when we look at a subsurface environment, that DNAPL very rarely approaches a saturation of 1, meaning it's very rarely occupying all the porosity or the pore space within it, that sand or that gravel, because the NAPL typically is sharing this space with water or air, and most porous media are water wetting. So there's still going to be some amount of water within all of these systems. But understanding the saturation, and in particular the residual saturation, which I'll talk to about in a moment, really affect whether or not that DNAPL is going to migrate or how mobile it is. And that, again, is really dictated by this concept of NAPL saturation and mobility. And so in general, when the NAPL saturation is less than what's known as the residual saturation, that NAPL will be immobile. So if we look at this pore space, that pore space is filled with water, it's filled with DNAPL. The residual saturation is the threshold with which that NAPL is mobile. So if it's less than residual saturation, it's immobile. If the NAPL occupies a much greater percentage of that porosity and it's greater than the residual saturation, then that NAPL may be mobile or potentially mobile. And so this really drives or determines when we're pulling these soil cores and we're looking at NAPL saturation, we're looking at how much NAPL has to fill that pore space before it becomes mobile. And it has to be continuous. And it also has to be able to transmit pressure. So you both have to exceed the residual saturation level, and there has to be a driving force in order for that NAPL to migrate and to be mobile. So when we're looking at movement of DNAPL or groundwater through a subsurface environment, one of the controlling characteristics is really the permeability. The permeability of a system describes this potential to transmit a fluid, and it's a function of both the fluid properties, like the water or the NAPL, and the media. In groundwater systems, permeability is affected by the presence of NAPL, and so the relative permeability is the permeability of the NAPL system, and it's a function of this NAPL saturation. In general, high saturation or areas that have high NAPL saturation, the overall effect is an apparent reduction in that relative permeability. And so if you have a sand system, say, and that permeability is, say, 10 feet per day, horizontal hydraulic conductivity, if you go out and you do slug tests or permeability tests and you measure that same system that has a high NAPL saturation, those results are going to tell you that that permeability is much lower because it takes a lot more pressure and it takes a lot more force to move a NAPL compared to water. So the effect is that in your NAPL saturated zones, you're going to measure a reduction in that horizontal hydraulic conductivity or permeability. So that can be important when you're evaluating the data from your site and really interpreting, you know, how permeable a system is for design calculations. So now that we've gone through some of these basic NAPL characteristics and talked about how the NAPLs behave in subsurface environments and the geologic materials, we're going to talk about what we call the life cycle of a DNAPL site. Understanding the subsurface behavior of DNAPLs is really technically challenging. And when we are going to move into describing site characterization and the tools, we really need to understand where we're at within this life cycle to understand what we expect and make sure we're developing appropriate data quality objectives and selecting appropriate tools so that we can get the properties and the characterization that we're really looking for a robust conceptual site model. So we're going to go through a basic sort of DNAPL life cycle. This is a very simplified cross-section, and this is a kind of a historical view of a DNAPL release where we've got an active source, this DNAPL, it's migrating vertically through the vadose zone. It hits the saturated zone. Here's the groundwater system, overcomes that capillary pressure, starts migrating vertically. And again, this vertical migration is dictated by the geologic media. As we hit these interfaces between more permeable and less permeable, that NAPL will accumulate, you know, on and start migrating laterally and then continues to migrate. And this is really a function of the amount of mass that's released and the geologic media and looking at these different sort of confining zones. Once that DNAPL is in this subsurface system, it starts to dissolve out and essentially creates a dissolved contaminant plume emanating from that source. So that's kind of our basic classical model. One of the things that our team really wants to highlight is that most of the time the systems that we're working with really don't behave like this classical model. And there's several reasons for that. One of those reasons is that there's a variety of what we call secondary sources. And most of the time, the sites that we're working in are decades old. So these releases happened a long time ago, and that mass has been distributed within that subsurface environment and had a lot of time to essentially sort of come to equilibrium. And so when we're using a conceptual site model that has this sort of DNAPL zone, often the hunt for DNAPL can be very distracting. People are trying to define sources, and they're trying to figure out where their DNAPL is, and they're trying to figure out how that DNAPL is loaded into the plume. And really, very often, DNAPL is really not the only source of groundwater contamination. As Mike alluded to, we really need to understand the effect of sorption and desorption. That aquifer matrix itself can actually hold, if you will, or sorb a lot of that contaminant mass, which as that site ages can result in desorption being one of the primary long-term sources of concentrations that you're seeing in your distal plume. And then also, like Mike alluded to, this concept of matrix diffusion that occurs over this very long time frame, and this back diffusion in particular can also feed especially low concentrations for a very long time. And so it really is sometimes these mechanisms, this desorption and back diffusion, that control the longevity of the dissolved phase plume. So you're often attributing that to a source or a residual source, but it's often these secondary sources that are more important. So as our conceptual site models for DNAPLs have evolved, we've gone from really looking at it as a DNAPL source plume relationship to now understanding that these secondary sources may be more important, especially for old sites, and that now we need to understand the impact and the loading from matrix diffusion and from sorption desorption effects. So let's talk about that a little bit, and in particular talk about sorption, and this really describes the portion of that chemical mass that adsorbs or sorbs onto the aquifer matrix at equilibrium. So it's based on the concentration of that chemical in water, and it's also based on the properties of that solid mass, those soil grains. And for organic chemicals, it's often driven by the amount of carbon that's within that aquifer matrix will sort of drive the amount of sorption that occurs. So again, this desorption contributes to first as that plume is evolving and that plume is migrating at the leading edge of the plume, the retardation that you see is often, that chemical retardation term is often driven by the sorption, because sorption is occurring, so it's removing mass from the plume, it's migrating or going off onto the sidelines of you, if you will, and then again in the long term it often drives the longevity of that plume. Because so the other important characteristic is really this concept of matrix diffusion, and that occurs when you have this early, what we call an early term site, you've got an active DNAPL release. That DNAPL is dissolving at very high concentrations that's migrating within your transmissive zone. Say this is a sand unit, for instance. You've got high concentrations. You've got this interface between the sand and the clay, and the concentrations in the matrix water of that clay are much, much lower than the concentrations in this plume. And so what happens is just by straight chemical diffusion, where you've got high concentrations migrating to lower concentration areas, you start to get this mass that migrates into these low permeability. This could be a silt, this could be a clay, this could be just a more compacted sand. So anywhere you have these variabilities and conductivities, we see this effect. And so then, you know, many decades go by that you got many pore volumes that flush through that transmissive zone. That DNAPL is now dissolved out. Your transmissive zone is relatively clean. But now what happens is if you got all this mass stored in these low permeability zones, and now that's back diffusing. So we see the tailing. We often talk about tailing at DNAPL sites, and you can get big reductions in concentration in a short term with remediation, but we see this tailing effect where you have elevated concentrations that persist for a very long time, and that's often because you have a diffusion-controlled plume. So here's the figure that Mike showed earlier, and again, we're just reiterating, like he said, this role of geology in this matrix diffusion phenomenon. And like I said, it can even be, this is, you look at this core and you're thinking this is sand, sand, and more sand, but you've got these very fine transitions where you might have a more transmissive sand layer here, a 10 to the minus 2 centimeter per second, next to maybe a really compacted sand. And so you've got a much lower overall permeability. And what happens is that all of your flow or your advection, that groundwater plume migration, if you will, is occurring in this layer. But this layer is where all the storage occurs because of diffusion. So you've got all this mass that's migrating from these high permeability zones into these low permeability zones. So one of the ways that we have advocated sort of conceptualizing all of these different phenomenon and ensuring that you're accounting for them in your conceptual site model is to use something called the 14-compartment model. And this was initially developed by Tom Sale and Chuck Newell, and it really just provides a framework that allows you to make sure that you're accounting for all the different phases of chemical mass, the vapor, the DNAPL, the dissolved, and the sorbed, and that you're also accounting for this permeability effect. So you've got low permeability zones, and you have transmissive zones, and you have your source, and you have your plume. And so this really is where all these chemical fluxes occurring between these different layers, and are you making sure that you're accounting for things like matrix diffusion and back diffusion and sorption in your conceptual site model? And so how that affects your conceptual site model, if you have this early stage, this is what I talked to earlier in this training, this is how we often conceptualize it. We know we have high mass in the transmissive zone, in the DNAPL zone, but we've got mass volatilizing and it's dissolving, and in the transmissive zones, that plume is migrating down gradient in that transmissive zone. We have sorption occurring, so we've got mass, but over many decades, and then just one more thing here is that very often these heavy, viscous NAPLs like creosote and coal tars, because they tend to have very low mobilities in the subsurface environment, they have very low solubilities, and they have very low vapor pressures, they tend to sort of stay where they're at. They sort of tend to stay put. And so this early stage behavior where you've got a very defined DNAPL source tends to be true for the long term for these creosote and coal tars. And you don't tend to get these, what we call these later stage or middle stage sites, which are characteristic of a lot of chlorinated solvent sites. So in this case, that DNAPL release is used up, or there's no longer a DNAPL release, and you primarily have just this residual NAPL that's vertical within that subsurface environment, and you've had things like back diffusion or diffusion and sorption. And so when we look at where the mass is distributed between the source and plume, you tend to have just relatively high concentrations and mass distributed relatively evenly between all of these different compartments, if you will. And this is really driven, again, by back diffusion. In this case, we're not conceptualizing these plumes as these plume fronts migrating where you have high concentrations and it's sort of logarithmic and it's migrating advectively. We're now conceptualizing our plumes, looking at them as more like stream tubes because of heterogeneity and the way that these systems are typically constructed structurally from a geology perspective. We've got these high concentration stream tubes, and it really is diffusion out of those stream tubes that's controlling the plumes and the evolution of the dissolve phase plume. So in this case, again, this is really where heterogeneity is replacing homogeneity. We often will make simplifying assumptions, and that is often what is misinforming our conceptual site models. We need to understand in sufficient detail the heterogeneity of the system and where we have transmissive zones and where we have low conductivity zones, so we can understand the significance of things like matrix diffusion and sorption and how DNAPLs historically migrated within our subsurface systems. So we need to characterize and include an appropriate level of heterogeneity within our conceptual site models. And then we have this sort of last late stage site, if you will, and this is really where you no longer really even have DNAPL, and now all the remaining mass is in these low conductivity zones within the source and within the plume, and it really is back diffusion and sorption which is driving the concentrations and the longevity of that plume. So Juliana will go ahead and open the next poll question, and thinking about cycle assessment and the life cycle at your sites that you're working on, do you think you're working on an early stage site, a middle stage site, or a late stage site? So this is very typical. This is also probably reflected in that a lot of the folks working on this training are working with a lot of chlorinated solvent sites, which tend to be older, but also creosote and coal tar sites. You know, some of those that I've been working on, you know, the original releases happened in the late 18, early 1900s. You know, they're really old. And so this is, you know, the majority of folks, 74%, are working on what we term late stage sites, where we think, you know, there was sources originally, those are likely dissolved out, and now we're probably dealing with a situation where we have a significant amount of diffusion or sorption that's really controlling the plume. We have quite a few folks working on a middle stage, so you might still have some residual NAPL, and then a few folks working on early releases or early stage, or maybe some folks working on creosote coal tar, which again, those sites tend to behave mostly as this early stage because you have this very defined, highly saturated NAPL system. So, Juliana, we could probably go ahead and close the poll. So our take-home message in this section is that you really need to understand both your DNAPL and you need to understand the site that you're working with, because they really are integrally linked. And characterizing DNAPL sites need to take into account things like geology and depositional environment and relevant stratigraphic units. You know, we don't want to just throw our borehole logs in the back of our annual reports. We want to bring them up into the conceptual site model and make sure that we're accounting for these phenomenon in the geology in the conceptual site model when we're characterizing the site. We need to understand the characteristics of our DNAPLs, get site-specific information on our DNAPLs, really look at how our particular DNAPL could be distributed within the subsurface system we're working in. If you're working in a glacial till, if you're working in a fractured rock, if you're working in a sandy aquifer, I mean, all of those are going to have different implications for how you might characterize that site. And really looking at and understanding and thinking about this life cycle of your site. Are you really primarily addressing a system that's diffusion controlled or not? And how do all of these things play into defining our data quality objectives and developing a characterization program that's going to give us a sufficient amount of detail so that we can build a conceptual site model and make more robust remediation and management decisions? And so with that, we're actually going to open it up for a few minutes for some questions before we move on.
Thanks, Tamsin. Anyone is welcome to use that Q&A pod in the lower right to send in questions or comments, and even throughout the second half of the training, you are welcome to use that Q&A pod to send in questions. For our phone line audience, you also have the option of unmuting your phone, that's #6 to unmute, and asking questions out loud. At this point, I'll also remind you, we do look for you to fill out the feedback before we wrap up today. So in that related links, the fourth item down, takes you to our feedback form. We really do use the information that you provide not only to improve today's training class, but also as we're developing new classes. And so we are getting ready to start developing a new class with some of the very same trainers on today's call. It's a great time for you to give us feedback on things that you'd like to see more of, things that we can improve on. Please give us your feedback. The feedback form also provides the opportunity for you to create a certificate of participation for today's training class. And right now, it's only through the feedback that you can do that. So be sure to check the box to certify that you attended at the bottom of the feedback form. Once you submit the feedback, the system is going to generate a certificate of participation for you. So this is a great opportunity to get a certificate for today's training. I'll also remind you, next week on December 13, we're offering Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy. Michael mentioned this training class earlier in the training. This is another class by many of the same trainers. So December 13th, Tuesday, same time, Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy. If you haven't registered already, you can register from the ITRC website, which is www.itrcweb.org. Do you have any questions from the phone line audience? We have not had any questions come in online, so we'll go ahead and continue on with the second half of today's training. If you do have a question anytime throughout the training class, you are welcome to send that using that Q&A pod in the lower right, and we'll try to get to questions at the end of today's training class. We'll go ahead and move forward to the next section of the training, and I'm going to turn the presentation over to Trevor King in Warrenton, Pennsylvania. Trevor?
Thank you, Juliana, and good morning or afternoon, everyone, depending on where you are. Can you hear me, Juliana?
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you for that introduction, Tamsin. That was excellent. Now that we've heard about DNAPL characteristics and the life cycle of a DNAPL site, I think it's time for us to discuss this process we are calling integrated site characterization. So let me just moving right along. This is where we are, slide 48. For those who are following along. This is a process that really integrates a couple of things. It integrates planning, it has a tool selection, and it discusses the implementation and evaluation of characterization data. One major highlight you will hear about this afternoon is about a new and exciting data collection tools and techniques that was developed as part of this guidance document. In summary, the integrated site characterization process can really was really presented and described in a couple of chapters, chapters 4 through 6 in the guidance document. And the purpose of the document was really to help users, such as you and I, prepare more accurate conceptual site models. The key word here is accurate, and that translates into a more, what I would say, effective integrated DNAPL site strategy, which was the focus of the 2011 document Michael mentioned and will be presented next week. My goal in this portion of the presentation is to provide you with a couple of things. One, I want to provide an overview of the characterization process and introduce a roadmap that is used to develop, and help you navigate the process. We also want to talk about a few benefits in the guidance document. If we can't see the value of doing this, it's going to be hard to convince our clients and our regulators that it's really needed and there's a benefit to using this technique. Then I'm going to describe one of the three modules in the characterization process. And finally, I'm going to introduce an example site that is used throughout the presentation. So I'm going to lay the foundation for this example site that my colleagues will, that I and my colleagues will use throughout the remainder of this presentation. So with that, let's get cracking. So the question we want to ask ourselves is, so what is integrated site characterization? For the guidance document, it consists of three modules. And as shown in the slide here, we describe it as a flexible, iterative, eight-step process that really can be used to encourage development. You can either use it to develop or to refine an existing conceptual site model. That is what is shown on the right side of this slide. And this is our roadmap. This is figure 4-1 in the guidance document. The eight-step process was developed really to focus on a couple of particular aspects that are common to DNAPL site characterization. However, I think it's fair to say this process can be used in any type of characterization program, but our focus in this document and for this presentation is on DNAPL. The process is one that can be used to develop what we describe as clear, actionable data collection objectives, and we want to be able to select the appropriate tools for optimal data collection. And this needs to consider the site conditions and the data needs as part of our characterization program. So I mentioned at the beginning, we wanted to talk about a couple of benefits. These benefits can, in my opinion, best be understood in light of the common problems with DNAPL sites. If I was to consider what these are, basically, when you think of the benefits of characterization, you're looking at ways that you can reduce the uncertainty and use this to enable you to develop more accurate conceptual site models. You may start a program and you may have a hypothesis of a conceptual site model of what things may look like, but you really want to get a good and as accurate as practical representation of what lies in the subsurface, because you're going to be spending a lot of money and implementing a remedial action that is very costly. So we got to get this right the first time. So we want to be able to reduce the uncertainties. Second, we're looking to basically improve the identification, also the collection, and the evaluation of any data that is collected. If we can't collect efficient data or representative data, it's going to be difficult to implement an effective remedy. One of the things on this side speaks to the integrated DNAPL site strategy guidance document, 2011 document. This document goes into depth into the strategy. And it's presented next week, and I really encourage you to take some time and attend this webinar if you have not already done so. A third benefit of the integrated site characterization process is one whereby we want to avoid costly do-overs. Nobody wants to be in a position where they have to tell their client, this is not working and we need to do more. But, you know, it's inevitable in some instances simply because of poor characterization that was initially done. But if it's necessary, we got to do it. But this is something this process can help us to avoid in the future. And the fourth benefit that it can be used for is really to get all the stakeholders around the table and basically agree on a plan before it's implemented. And this plan will be not only agreed by the clients and the consultants, but also by the regulators and any stakeholders that may be involved. If we can do this, we have a good starting platform for a successful integrated site characterization program that eventually leads into an effective remedial action. So here we have what is shown as the roadmap that I mentioned, and it includes a couple of things. As I mentioned earlier, it's an eight-step process with it's an eight-step process divided into three modules. Shown here is the first module, which is the planning module, which is referred to as the plan characterization, and it includes four elements. You want to be able to, as part of this plan, you want to be able to define the uncertainties and the deficiencies in your existing conceptual site model, if one exists. You want to be able to identify data needs and resolution appropriate for site conditions. You also want to be able to develop clear, actionable data collection objectives. And basically, you're looking to design a data collection and analysis plan that is flexible and adaptive. So those are the first four elements of the first four steps or elements of the characterization plan. Following that, the second module is all about selecting your investigation tools. And this is based on your data needs and the hydrogeologic environment. So you have to have a sense of what you'll be working with and what the potential needs may be. And my colleague Jeremy will present more about this when I'm done. And the third module, which is shown on the slide and includes three steps, is all about implementing the investigation. This also includes evaluating and interpreting the data, and then there is a loop. If you look closely, you can see there's a loop. It's a feedback loop that points back either to the implementation program or to the planning phase, because you basically want to make sure that your conceptual site model is robust and accurate. So if you need to go back, that's what you do. And Heather will speak to that after Jeremy. So before we get into the planning phase, which is where I'm going to spend a bit of my time, we have a poll question for you. And this information is used to help us guide the remainder of the presentation, not only for myself, but for my colleagues. So do you have a site that is being characterized for the first time or where prior characterization was insufficient? You have yes, first time, yes, insufficient, because you may be doing additional work. It may be a phased investigation, characterization, or the data suggests that sources are not known and you need to do more, and you're convinced your client that you need to go back, or simply no. From your responses, I see that most of us are working at sites where there may have been insufficient data collected, and because many of our sites are a decade or more old, this is not uncommon. We've kind of seen this trend throughout the presentations, and this is one of the reasons that we've realized that this type of document is so important for future work and even for correcting problems that exist at some sites. I was actually working at the site earlier this year where soil and the groundwater treatment system, SV system and the pumping treatment system was installed in the 90s, and by 2016, it was still not achieving its objectives, and everybody's showing up in their arms. And after 20 years of spending money behind remedial systems, you can well expect that the client is not happy. Needless to say, the regulators are asking for more. So it's important that we understand how to manage these processes going forward. So, Juliana, can be you. So with that full question out of the way, I want to move on to the planning section. But before I do so, there is going to be, there's one thing that kind of, sorry about that. Yeah, there's one thing I want to clarify ahead of time, because when we were preparing this document during the review process, there was much discussion about what we were doing and what currently exists in our industry. In around 2006, the EPA put out the data quality objectives, and these seven steps here seem to be very similar to what we are proposing. What I'd like to say by showing this slide is that the seven steps of the DQO process were actually considered and integrated into the four steps of the planning phase of the integrated site characterization. The characterization program builds on these data quality objectives in the planning phase and extends it to the tool selection and then the actual implementation and a holistic approach to the site characterization. So with that cleared up, I hope there is no confusion as you read the guidance document and as we continue in this presentation. So I mentioned earlier that there are four steps to the planning phase, and that's where I'm going to spend the remainder of my time. So I'm going to talk about the four steps, and in each step, between each step, I'm going to switch to an example site, and this is the site that we will all use during the remainder of the presentation to illustrate the points we are making. So the first step is all about, we got to be able to define our problem, and we got to be able to assess the CSM uncertainties. We got to know what we're dealing with and how to manage and know this. The challenge here is really the ability to define this problem in terms of uncertainties. Because if you ask different people, everyone has a different opinion. So you got to come to some consensus. You got to be able to understand better what is missing and what is needed. For example, if the problem, let's say, is the extent of contamination, it's not fully defined, then the uncertainty in this case might be about maybe you don't have enough data. You have low data density. It could be in one direction or multiple directions. You may not understand where the groundwater is flowing. If you don't know where groundwater is flowing, it's difficult to complete your characterization and develop a remedial action. You may also have a situation where, you may have an ineffective remedy in place, and there may be uncertainty about whether you got all the sources during the initial characterization or there are additional sources. So that's just something you need to consider. A second aspect in this step is about being able to critically review existing information. As we saw from the poll question, many of us are working at sites where there is insufficient data, suggesting that there is some data. We got to take this data, and we got to be able to use it to develop a plan that incorporates and builds and is used to build on, so that we can, again, rethinking of a conceptual site model that is holistic and it's more representative of things in the subsurface. So some of the things that we may want to consider, could be, maybe in the uncertainties, it's basically about, you got to look at the lithology, you're thinking of the heterogeneity, as Thompson mentioned a number of times. You may be thinking of, is profiling, the vertical profiling resolution sufficient? Do you need more or less? Are you using wells? Are you using with long screens? Are you using graph samples? These are some of the things you probably want to consider. Also, some of the uncertainties may lie around the sources. You need to understand, was it a pure source? Was it a mixture? Any of these things can affect your conceptual site model. Finally, we want to look at, we may want to look at the chemicals in the subsurface, in the groundwater, for example. You want to look at the parent compounds. You want to look at the daughter products, just to get a sense of, where things are. You want to look at their distribution in the plume, their ratios. So all of these things you need to consider when you're thinking about defining your problem and assessing your uncertainties. So that was the first step. So as I said, after each step, we want to kind of look at this in terms of a case example. So for this case example, this is a site that one of our members of our team worked on. And this is a site that's in Indiana. And basically, just to kind of set this up, this is a dry cleaner, and it was actually one of three that they worked on at the same time, where PC was discharged to the groundwater, to the soil and groundwater. This work was done between 2004 and 2007, where they went in and they did characterization, and they basically used traditional methods and techniques. And as part of that program, they installed a number of borings, both where the triangle, in this case, represents monitoring wells, and the circle represents soil borings. As you can see at this site, there was a dry cleaner, and just by way of reference, to the south you had some residences, as well as to the east you had some apartments, gasoline station. To the north, not listed, but there were additional residences there, and to the west you had some garages. Based on the work that was done between 2004 and 2007, they actually installed these borings. They actually installed five monitoring wells, shown by the triangles, and then they collected 18 soil borings by the circles. What they didn't do at that time was look at soil gas. Vapor intrusion was not a big issue back in the early 2000s, so not much work was done. Shown here in black is what they delineated as the dissolved plume, and this area is about 15,000 square feet, with a limited number of borings, as represented by the blue hatch line, is where they assumed or they concluded the source area existed. In 2008, for this site, the consultants at that time proposed, and the department, environmental department, approved an ISCO approach for the source area, a one-time injection, and then for the dissolved plume, they proposed to do bio. So that's the setting for this example site. So we are going to turn our attention to what we consider to be the problem here. So what I want to say is that while there seem to be a lot of samples. Excuse me. I think I skipped heavy fingers. Yep. So we are looking at defining the problem at this example site. So, what the where the uncertainty lied was with the plume delineation, both the dissolved plume as well as with the source area. There was a lot of interpolation with respect to the data. And this is going to be clarified a little later, a slide or two later. You see what I mean by that. So they speculated where the source area was and the plume delineation. Also, when they implemented the ISCO approach in 2008, they didn't really have the ISCO approach and the bio approach. Did they really have a robust monitoring program for this remedial action? So they injected it and they kind of waited around, collected a bit of data every now and again. And it was not until 2010, when they decided to go back and collect data, then lo and behold, they saw the groundwater concentrations were still similar to what they were back in 2008. And this raised a lot of problems for the client from the Department of Environmental Management. In addition, one of the uncertainties, by 2010, VI became more prominent, and so they had no data for soil gas to kind of figure out what lied where in this subsurface. So those are kind of some of the uncertainties that were identified with this site. So the whole program, after this was to figure out well, we got a problem. The department, Indiana Department of Environmental Management, not happy. They had to go back and they came up with this new characterization plan, which is going to unfold during the remainder of this presentation. So that was the first step of our recharacterization of this site. So another step two of the whole process, which is basically about being able to identify the data needs and the gaps and what type of resolution you're looking for. So the first challenge is how to translate these uncertainties to your conceptual site model. I mean, this is where the art of our practice really comes into being. You've got to have good data in order to do so. One of the challenges associated with this. A second challenge is if you don't have sufficient spatial resolution, this is a bit more challenging because you may not know the scale of the controlling heterogeneities at your site. What you want is spatial resolution that really enables you to assess the nature of the subsurface heterogeneity and figure out what is actually controlling the contaminant distribution and transport in the subsurface. So this phase, this step two that we're talking about, is all designed to get a good understanding of what these are and build that into your characterization planning phase. So if we were to take that back to our to our example site, if you were to switch back, there were three primary data gaps that naturally flow from these uncertainties that were basically identified in step one of this process. You may recall the uncertainties existed around, as I mentioned, the completeness of the source zone and the plume delineation. Then there was, the second one was the effectiveness of the in-situ remedies. And the third one was the degree of vape intrusion threat to the occupants or nearby buildings. So if we look at the data gaps that were identified, we can summarize them as, first, there was contaminant concentrations in soil and groundwater that was needed to bung the source area and plume. And they needed to do this both laterally and vertically. If we, again, look at the slide, when they did the work initially, I mentioned you can see there are very few sample locations to the southern portion of the site. This was because they had access issues between the property owner of the dry cleaner and the residences. So they didn't get access to go off-site, so they limited a couple of borings in this area. So that was one. In addition to that, to the east, you can see there are very few borings and wells in this area. Again, it was access issues. There was a road. They couldn't work in the roadway, but they went across the road and they took a couple of borings and they installed a well here, and they used that as the basis. But the bottom line is what they realized after 2010 that this remedial action was not working, that something was amiss, and they were then forced to go back and then even to look, try to look a little bit closer in the southern and eastern portions of the site. So they wanted to get a more thorough understanding of the groundwater plume, as well as take additional soil samples to confirm this source area and really tighten it up as much as possible. And then, as I mentioned, they wanted to do something with soil gas. So here, just to illustrate the point I mentioned earlier, the data that was initially collected, when it was put into a cross-section as part of the conceptual site model, we can see that to the eastern portion of the site, they found impacts down to about 12 feet, but here you can see it was not delineated. As they moved from east to west, it is seen that only up to about 3 or 5 feet, and we may stand and ask, well, how is this possible that they did not understand what was at depth? That's a question that many of us will ask. But the bottom line is, whatever was done between 2004 and 2007 did not truly characterize the subsurface in the unsaturated zone, as well as in the saturated zone at depth. So this is just a section, and this was taken into consideration. All of this data was taken into consideration as they were planning the recharacterization effort. So if we can continue to move along. So we've completed two of the four steps. The third step is really completed after the first two. And it's about all about establishing data collection objectives. And the key point here that I want to make sure that I explain carefully is that we can't make, or we should not make or establish objectives before we understand the problem. Very often you hear about a site and the first thing we want to do is to say we're going to remediate to, you know, MCLs or whatever it is without actually going in, getting some data and figuring out or agreeing with a regulator of what needs to be done or what is practical. So once we define the problem, we identify the data needs and data gaps, whether it's a new or an existing site, then we are in a position to establish what we are considering to be data collection objectives. These objectives need to be very specific, they need to be clear, and they need to be actionable. And this is something that is developed much more in the Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy document that was released in 2011. And as I mentioned again, and my colleagues have mentioned, there's going to be a presentation webinar next week that speaks specifically about establishing what we consider as SMART objectives. SMART being an acronym for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound. Any program needs to meet these criteria. And then we also need to consider the type of data, the quantity and the quality, and the data density and the resolution as part of our collection objectives. So, when we establish site characterization objectives, we should really be thinking in terms of, first of all, determining what are the broad objectives, and then we can narrow it down into measurable objectives. So a broad objective could be, as shown in this slide, we may want to be able to delineate, let's say, the extent of the dissolved plume. Remember, there was a problem with soil, groundwater, and vapor intrusion. So we're only looking at groundwater in this particular example. So we want to delineate the extent of the dissolved plume. We want to determine stability. Is it attenuating? And then if we can do that, and everyone agrees, the next step is to break this down into, let's say, actionable objectives. And what would that look like? We may say, okay, we want to collect groundwater samples at X and Y depths. We want to collect soil borings every X feet to capture subsurface variability. Or we may want to delineate to drinking water standards or some other standard, maybe a risk-based standard that was developed for the site. We agree that we want to install some wells, whether it's 3 or 5, You got to agree to something and start with that. And then if you're going to do some work in the field and install wells, et cetera, you'll need to develop a monitoring program. You say maybe quarterly for a year or 2 years. You got to take this data, you got to manipulate it, you got to look at it, make decisions out of it. You develop graphs, maybe concentration versus time graphs or some other type of graph. You also want to look at your contaminants of concern and look at it in relation to the geochemical parameters in the subsurface. So this is just a representation of what a data collection objective could be. And then we will look at this in terms of our site. But before we do, Juliana, can you just open up this question? So the question is, have you ever collected data that was not optimal for deciding what to do next? And it's not a trick question, but it's one that that we have all encountered. And the bottom line is, sure we have, Most of us have collected data that we think we need one more data point, and as we go out here, we should get this, but that runs into problems. So it's good if you can agree on what you need and basically just collect that data and use it. Thank you. So as I prepare to conclude, I want to just turn this collection objectives to our site. This example site that was recharacterized. So for the broad objectives, what they decided to do, they were going to define the plume, exceeding the Indiana standards. They were then next going to assess the remedy progress as part of the characterization program to look at the soil and groundwater data to figure out how effective the remedial actions were. They were also going to assess shallow soil vapor and VI threat as part of the recharacterization. One of the key points with the whole program was the ability to do this in days, not weeks, as in the first iteration. As I said, it was 2004 to 2007. That lengthy time frame leads to a lot of inefficiencies, and the team felt that rapid or sufficient resolution and more timely characterizations are much more cost effective and help to make decisions in a timely manner. The data types and collections and resolution that was collected, they decided to use continuous cores, samples that the ecologic boundaries were agreed upon. They were going to collect groundwater samples at a certain frequency, in this case it was 4 feet, and then they decided at each location, and they selected a number of locations, they were going to collect soil gas at each of at each location. So that's the three steps, and if you have those three steps agreed upon, the next thing you need to do is to put that into some type of work plan. We gotta write this up in a way that everyone is in agreement, and more important, when the work plan or the work goes from the office to the field team is very familiar with what needs to be done and how this whole process is going to work. So in writing a work plan, we need to recognize the data limitations as part of our program. We need to select the data management tool we're going to use. We're going to develop whatever type of analytical process is going to be used as well. And one plug here is basically a need to consider real-time analysis. In many of our characterization programs. The team had a wide variety of over 30 plus practitioners, and everyone attested to the benefit of real-time analysis in many occasions and the value it brings not only to the project, but in terms of controlling costs. So here's just a quick picture of what was done for this example site. You see the soil sampling probes, the clusters, you had two, one for, I think it was 5 and 12 feet or 10 feet. They had a mobile lab. They basically used a triad approach. What I didn't mention is that this is one of three sites within a 5-mile area that were all characterized at the same time. They were all dry cleaners. And so the client had the opportunity to propose characterizing or recharacterizing all three sites with one mobilization. So this lab actually analyzed, the mobile lab analyzed over 600 samples, about 65 samples a day for about 10 days. The original program was 15 days, but they were able to, by just trying to implement some efficiencies, were able to complete their work within a 10-day period as opposed to 15 days. So needless to say, the client was extremely happy with our team members, with our team member. And this is basically what was proposed for the recharacterization. They agreed with the regulator that they would go back and do some additional delineation. The yellow shows the plan that includes 16 soil borings, proposed borings. And in each of these borings, they were going to collect 5 samples. They were going to do this down to about 25 feet. They were going to collect in the saturated zone about 3 samples per boring, between 15 and 25, for about 48 graph samples. And you can see the distribution. Still, they had problems in the southern area of the site getting access. They still had some problems, as you can see, in the southern area of the site. But they decided to put more borings in that area and collect soil and groundwater samples, a few more and eastern, and then they confirmed with another boring location over here. The initial characterization showed that the plume did not reach on the other side of the road, but they just wanted to go back and do some confirmation. And the last bit of work that they did is they looked at soil gas. They did 12 points, as you can see by the orange circles. And at each location, as I showed in the picture, you had a cluster of 2 points each. So that was the recharacterization program that was proposed for this site, and is being used as just to illustrate the concept of this integrated site characterization. So in conclusion, you know, what I'd like to say is, what we looked at this afternoon is in situ characterization, and what I did is I tried to introduce the roadmap that was developed to guide this process at sites. I mentioned a few benefits, and I also covered the DQO process and its inclusion in the planning module. And we also looked at about the three modules that is shown here. That is the planning module, the tool selection, and the implementation phase. And then we discussed the four steps of the planning module. And I tried to illustrate each of these steps with an example site. Here you can see the four steps, each of them being illustrated with the example site. So at this time, what I'd like to do, I'd like to turn this back to Juliana, and so we can move on. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Trevor. In the next section of the training, we're going to go to Jeremy Munson at Pinion Environmental. Jeremy? And Jeremy, you may need to unmute your phone.
Right. I need to unmute my phone. Thank you. So at this point, we're going to take a look at how we might be able to identify tools that we can use to work ourselves through our site characterization based on the objectives developed earlier in the plan. And as we were putting together the document, we recognized that there were a lot of tools out there to help us meet our characterization objectives. Unfortunately, many of the tools were either underutilized or poorly understood. So moving forward, I'll be going through a tool selection framework that we developed to add more options to our collective toolbox. And to facilitate the selection process, we put together a matrix of generally available proven tools and methods for data collection. In this section, we'll provide a brief orientation to the tools matrix, discuss the framework that was used to develop the matrix, and run through the functionality and filtering options that are available. Well, then we'll wrap it up with a couple of case examples, one of which will be building off of the case study that Trevor introduced earlier. So we'll start here with another quick poll. I'm wondering, would like to see which of the tools in the list you've actually used during site investigation. As we wait for the answers to come in, I just share that until I got involved with the ITRC team, I'd maybe heard of the bottom four on a really cursory, superficial level, but I definitely never worked anything like that into my site characterization. And it just really becomes a matter of education. And as the results are coming in, this is pretty typical. The top four or five are pretty big go-tos for us in the professional consulting industry and regulatory industry. And it comes down to this being a, we don't know what we don't know. We can't be expected to incorporate methods that we've never heard of into our plan. So let's move on. So that's where the tools matrix comes into play. And as noted earlier at the beginning of the session, the matrix is available for download from the ITRC website, and it's hyperlinked here in the underlined text up in this first bullet. And the tools in the matrix are segregated into categories and subcategories to facilitate navigation. It's important to understand that the tools presented are a snapshot of what was available and had been vetted relatively thoroughly at the time the matrix was developed. And I'll add to this that in the time since we published the DNAPL document, we've heard from several users that the matrix is pretty functional and applicable for sites outside of the DNAPL nexus. And let's get a little bit oriented to the matrix. As shown here, this is a screenshot of what the matrix looks like. It contains over 100 tools that have been sorted by characterization objectives. The primary objectives that we're going to identify in our site characterization plan, their effectiveness in different types of media, whether it be bedrock or unconsolidated geology, the saturated or unsaturated zones, and then ranked by their data quality objective, and whether or not they're going to return, their data quality, whether or not they're going to return quantitative, semi-quantitative, or qualitative results. And then within the tool, the matrix, we are able to get additional information by clicking on navigable links within the table. Here, if we click on one of the characterization objective categories, we can get more details on why these are important in consideration. Beyond that, we can also get more information on each of the tools by clicking on hyperlinks associated with them, which will provide us additional reference material, descriptions of the particular tool, a summary of that, how it may be applicable to our specific data quality and the advantages and disadvantages as well as limitations of a particular tool. And then to allow relatively clear and quick understanding of what the tool may be able to do, the green shaded boxes here allow us to visualize and understand whether or not a particular tool might be suited for a data quality objective or data objective, characterization objective. So using the tools matrix, again, understanding there are more than 100 tools in the matrix, and that's a bit daunting to sort through even with some green boxes. We built some filters that allow the user to down select appropriate tools to meet particular characterization objectives. It's a systematic process that allows us to select our categories, the parameters of interest, the geologic media that we'd be working on, whether or not we're working in a saturated aquifer or unsaturated zone, and our data quality objectives. We apply those filters to evaluate the tools for effectiveness, availability, and cost. And ultimately, we need to understand that the selection of the tools is going to be site-specific, and it will be dependent on the team's experience, the availability of a particular tool, and the cost. So let's take a look at how this works, and we'll run through how we select things throughout with the filters. First, we select our category, our data, or our characterization objective category, whether it be geology, hydrology, or chemistry. And you'll note here that under chemistry, we have multiple options depending on the matrix that we're interested in. And so we have the ability to select any or all of these. And then we can select the parameters of interest under each of those characterization objectives. And what's available to us as we move through the filter set are only those options that are found or that are applicable to the parent. So here we started with our geology as our type, and the lithology, contacts, porosity, et cetera, are the only ones that are available to us. Then we can look at the geologic media, bedrock or unconsolidated. We can, again, select all. And the zone that we'll be working in. So here we'll run with saturated. And then our data quality objective. Again, we may be looking for a hard number or something in between, or really we just need something relative to our site. And then once we run the filter, we click the search button, and it filters out. Sorry about that. You'll see at the top of the matrix, there's a summary of the parameters that we've selected. And then the list is distilled down into these particular ones that are applicable to the objectives that we've selected. So within the tool, we can also run additional searches for a whole new set of characterization objectives. This would be run from the DNAPL tab within the tool. Again, we'd use the DNAPL tab, enter our objectives for the filters, and then run the search. Or we can build onto a previous search by just adding or reestablishing new objectives under the same filter on the same tab and running additional search. So then once we are able to identify once we run through our filters, we can incorporate the selected tools into our characterization plan. We'll implement that plan, evaluate the data returned, and update our conceptual site model. Then we have to reassess the characterization objectives. We need to know, did we actually meet our goals? And if not, how do we have to modify what our plan is and our approach? And as noted several times before, this is an iterative process. We don't just stop here unless we have reached a sufficient level of detail and characterization at our site. So we're going to now just crack right into the case example introduced by Trevor. And we'll pull out a specific characterization objective that was identified at the time, noting that the tools matrix wasn't available at the time that the case work was done. So our characterization objective that we'll use would be to delineate the lateral and vertical extent of the dissolved face plume, determine the stability and rate of attenuation. Our goals are to define the boundary exceeding groundwater standards, assess remedy progress for both soil and groundwater, and then assess shallow soil vapor impacts. So here's how that looks in the filters that we'd select. We'd be using chemistry in all of the matrices. Our parameter is contaminant concentration, and we are looking in the unconsolidated zone, and we're interested in both the saturated and unsaturated areas, and we're looking for a quantitative data quality objective. Entering those into our filter set, this would be the summary that's returned at the top. And we run the filter, and this is the data set that we're returned with. So ultimately, our search from 120 or so tools returns 22 that are applicable to our characterization objective. And considering the desire to expedite the assessment, our project team selected direct push soil and groundwater sampling, an active soil gas survey, and an on-site mobile lab. Let's take a look at another example. We have this one and one more coming up. Another characterization objective to determine the porosity of fractured bedrock formation in a DNAPL source zone and to evaluate the potential storage capacity of the rock. So we're looking at geology and porosity as our primary parameter in bedrock and saturated zones. We're looking for a qualitative data objective. Running these through the filter, here's the summary of our inputs. And our output distilled over 100 tools to 10 that are applicable to the characterization objective. It's a lot more manageable that way, easier to navigate these and then have a discussion as a project team. And our final example, objective to evaluate potential matrix diffusion issues associated with various variations in hydraulic conductivity. Here we'll be looking at hydrogeology, hydraulic conductivity, and the unconsolidated subsurface, again saturated, and we'll start out looking for at all of our data quality options, quantitative, semi-quantitative, and qualitative. Summary of our inputs again, and here's our output. In this one, we've got 21 tools that come back, and maybe this is a little bit more than we want to deal with, so maybe we can refine this down a bit. So we're going to refilter this, This time we'll take a look and we'll modify the data quality objective to just qualitative tools. And when we do that, our tool returns 7 options for us to consider as project team. So I kind of went through that pretty quickly, I understand, and please feel free to send some questions to me if you'd like me to clarify as we go along. But in summary, the characterization objectives guide our selection of tools. Our interactive tools matrix, which is downloadable from the ICRC website, includes over 100 tools that have detailed descriptions and information that you can navigate to. It involves a systematic selection process to filter down what might be available to us and what is applicable. And we select our tools, we implement the work plan, evaluate our results, and align data gaps with our characterization objectives, always considering the conceptual site model and how that might need to be updated as we move along. And the most important part of all this is that we have to remember we don't always get all of our information in the first cut or even the second. We may have to revisit this as more information becomes available. So repeating the process becomes a necessary part of our site characterization. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Heather.
Oh, thank you very much, Jeremy. I appreciate it. As you can tell, we're on slide 98, and we are entering the third module of the integrated site characterization and the last section before we venture into the summary. So in this third module, this section, and it's circled down the lower part of the slide, is all about, or the lower part of the flowchart, excuse me, it's all about getting things done. It's about implementing, getting out to the site, and not only implementing the investigation, but the next evaluating and interpreting the results that have been collected, and finally integrating and updating the CSM. In step 6, like I said, it's time to get into the field and conduct the investigation. Remember in step 4, it recommends using a flexible sampling plan such as the triad approach. And this will allow for adaptive and dynamic field work to help collect the data needed to meet the objectives which were established in step 3. And this is pointed out by Trevor as well as by Jeremy that this is an iterative approach, and a lot of times we're collecting data, looking at the data, deciding if we are meeting our objectives, and maybe making a decision to collect more data. So this also leads into not only step 6, but often the dynamic nature of the investigation has step 7, which is data evaluation, going on concurrently with step 6, and like I said, or implementing the investigation. As the data are collected, they're evaluated against the objectives. For example, if determining the extent of a plume is an objective, then the steps of collecting and analyzing the data against those project-specific concentrations are done multiple times in order to delineate the extent of the plume. On to slide 101, and here we're dealing with step 7. It's the data evaluation and interpretation, which often happens while implementing the investigation as well. For quite a few sites, step 7 may actually start back in step 1 with the assessing or the assessment of the CSM that's already established at the site if we're trying to figure out what's going on in a site that already has the CSM. I believe that was one of the answers of the poll questions. Most of us are trying to figure out what's happening at a site. Maybe not enough data was collected initially. So when you're trying to gain a better understanding of the site, it's through this thorough process of integrating all the data types via geology, hydrogeology, and chemistry, and then generating this collective data set and better understanding the uncertainties that were done in step one that led us through the remaining of the steps to be able to go out and collect the data. So now we have the data, and we're going to be bringing this additional data into the CSM to help improve the understanding at the site. And that's part of step seven, is evaluating and interpreting this data. And as Jeremy and Trevor were pointing out, it takes multiple lines of evidence for us to be able to evaluate some of these objectives, such as understanding contaminant transport, storage, how that might be impacting a plume's life cycle, and potentially assessing the attenuation capacity at a site. So let's talk about the case example at the dry cleaner site that's been going through all three of these modules. The data were evaluated with respect to the objectives determined in step three and documented in step four. And we should remember the first objective there was to define the boundary exceeding the groundwater conditions. And this boundary was evaluated or was investigated not only in terms of the lateral extent, but also in regards to the depth and the geology. The soil boring results for one location here were showing a blow up in a table. And this is where a mobile lab was used at 2-foot intervals, and a fixed lab sample was also collected in addition to the mobile lab. This illustrates the importance of establishing a relationship between the mobile results and the fixed results, as well as showing how the new data helped extend the vertical delineation because of the collection of the 2-foot intervals, as opposed to having more of 5 or 10 or 20-foot intervals. With respect to the updated lateral boundary, we can see here that there's differences between the old and the new plume lateral extent when we're drawing the isocontours based on the compliance standard. And here we can see with the new data that the plume extends slightly further southeast than previously expected, and also extends under a residence. The second objective was to assess the remedy progress using soil and groundwater samples. And concentrations were compared to the area previously treated. And the concentrations did reduce from around in the hundreds milligram per kilogram down to 1 to 5 milligram per kilogram, but that still is not near where they wanted to be for their remedial objectives. And then on to the next slide to talk about the third objective, which was to evaluate the vapor intrusion threats and whether or not a work plan was needed to be able to continue looking for vapor intrusion. Over 35 samples were collected, 35 vapor samples were collected at 17 points to evaluate this risk, this potential risk and threat. Vapor samples were collected at 2 depths, 3 to 4 feet below ground surface, and as well at 4 to 5 feet below ground surface, and compared to chronic screening levels, subchronic screening levels, and draft remediation closure guidance. And then we can see here at this particular location, again, they were comparing mobile and fixed labs. By plotting these results, the shape of the vapor plume starts taking place. And then we can figure out exactly where on-site and off-site concentrations would have been exceeding or are exceeding the extreme levels, and then addressing whether or not adjacent residences, particularly to the south of the site, whether or not there were any issues there. So on to opening up the next poll, Anna. So when do you typically update your CSM? So a little bit of a leading question, as Trevor had pointed out with some of our other poll questions. Do you update it anytime new data are collected? Maybe when a remedial technology fails? potentially when the CSM is determined to be inaccurate, maybe you're just following every five-year cycle, or no one is brave enough to say that they've never updated the CSM. So this is pretty good. This is when one would like to see is that when new data is collected, it's being updated, and then we're also recognizing when we have some inaccuracies, it's time to go out to the field and collect more data. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and move to the next slide, Juliana. Thanks. And this, of course, leads into step 8. So it was a bit of a leading question for the poll, from the poll, that the guidance advocates the concept of a living CSM, as we've already mentioned before, and data collected at any phase or at all phases of a project can be used. And that gets back to, you know, using data in step 1 and step 7 of this flowchart to form collaborative data sets that we can evaluate what's going on at the site and whether or not our objectives are being met. For example, beyond just characterization, you know, data needs change as the as projects progress. So for example, in the late phase, it could be driven by very specific questions on whether or not compliance is being met, whereas in an earlier phase, you know, delineating the extent of the plume is more the primary objective. But overall, it can't be said enough that a CSM is a living entity, and it should continue to evolve over the life cycle. And this also speaks to the integrated DNAPL site strategy training that's going to happen next week that talks about another flowchart looking at the progress of a remedy at a site and how important when remedy is not progressing as one would like, it is to go back to the top and reevaluate the CSM to make sure that the understanding of the site is correct or is as best as best understood as we can. So to the case examples, how is updating the CSM at this dry cleaners site working out? And we can see with the new information, we're putting it all on this particular figure. And we can take a look at the old contour. And what did the new data do for the old contour? It did change it. Like I said before, maybe some prove understanding horizontally as well as vertically. Here we can see, as Trevor was pointing out, the old understanding was not vertically delineated and it was presumed in certain areas, and the new site characterization at the site extended the source area. It extends further to the west than expected. So what are the benefits to the site characterization that that was done at these Indiana dry cleaners sites? Well, it confirmed the need for residential indoor evaluation due to a VI risk. This approach also, as Trevor pointed out, was done at 3 dry cleaner sites simultaneously and helped realize $50,000 in cost savings. So that's roughly about a third of the budget. Because things were done a little faster than expected in the field, about two-thirds of the time in the field was only needed. And in addition to the analytical contaminant data, the high-resolution geologic CSM was created based on the soil borings in the source area. And these soil borings and analysis helped indicate that the prior remedial action had reduced the PCE concentrations in the source area, like I said, from 100 milligrams per kilogram down to a range of 1 to 5. But there was still a ways to go, and that the source area was slightly different. It had kind of shifted, and it was not exactly where the folks had originally thought it to be. And with that, I'd like to turn the presentation back over to Michael for a summary.
Thanks, Heather. Definitely like to stress that you should read the document after this. I mean, we've talked about this in a couple of hours, and we really can't go into as much detail as we would like to. We're also probably going to have a four-hour short course at the AEHS conference on sediments in the spring in California, and possibly at the Patel conference. We're not sure about that one yet, though. But sort of, I'll give you sort of a summary. Planning is important. You have to understand, start your planning process by understanding what you can about the geology, understanding what you can about the contaminant. Then you work that together. So it'll help you come up with an initial work plan, which has got to be flexible, got to be adaptive. And then the tools table will help you pick the correct tools. And that's really important, too. So you'll start with that, and then you go to implementation. Now, just remember, this is an iterative process, too. This is not, it's not just one phase. I mean, you're out there. Your work plan is changing all the time, and your conceptual model is changing all the time. It sounds a little scary to some of the people who are paying for this, but you can actually, by spending a little more up front, see it a lot more in the long run. But again, I stress, conceptual site model is king, geology is king. Understand the geology, make sure your conceptual site model is continually updated. It's more of a process than a product. So, our path forward, we have to look back on the history. Too many DNAPL sites have been stalled, unresolved. A lot of the old sites where millions and millions have been spent are really just in long-term pump and treat. Examining DNAPL mobility and heterogeneous environments, it really promotes a better remedy selection. Understanding where your contaminants are, understanding where the sources are, understanding that DNAPL sites may not be just DNAPL, they're going to be dissolved phase too, especially with something like TCE, which is really high solubility. It may disappear after a number of years, and all your contaminant sources now no longer DNAPL, but the matrix diffusion, what storage of the carbon. Make sure when you're doing your characterization, you're not looking just at groundwater samples, you're taking soil samples, understand the soil chemistry, the fraction of organic carbon, natural oxygen demand. Remember, you can't have your work plan be very conclusive and look at the whole picture. And all this, in the end, what really does, better characterization really builds trust, and you get much better confidence in your site decisions. Stakeholders will understand it and be less concerned. The people actually paying for this, the problem holders will appreciate it because you do a much better job. You can get a remedy in first that actually does what you need. Not like the old days when we'd go out in the 70s or 80s where you go out and drill a bunch of holes, argue about it for 3 months, drill some more holes, argue, put in pump and treat and argue. We really have made this a much better system. And then the last thing I guess just once again is just understand your geology. Can't stress that enough. Juliana?
Thank you, Michael. We are going to have time for questions, so everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. At this point, I'll also remind you, we are looking for your feedback on today's training class, and we really appreciate it if you take just a few minutes to give us your feedback. You can follow the link here on slide 111 to our feedback form. At the end of the feedback form, there is a place where you can check to certify you attended the class. If you check that box, once you select submit, the system is going to generate a participation certificate for you. So that is something that if you can use, you are welcome to create a certificate for attending today's training class. Even if you don't need that, we would still like your feedback. It is something that we can use as we continue to develop new training classes. If you're on the phone line, you are welcome to ask questions out loud. Remember #6 to unmute your phone to ask questions. And of course, everyone is welcome to ask questions or send in questions using the Q&A pod in the lower right. And as we're finishing up today's class, I do have a few more poll questions for you. Would you recommend using the integrated DNAPL characterization strategy that we've described today? Yes, no, or do you still need to learn more information? And we do have that set to broadcast results so that you can see the answers that others are providing. And also, thinking about projects that you're working on, in the next 6 months, how could you use this ITRC guidance document?
So, Leanna, can you jump in and ask one of the questions, maybe provide a little answer to one of the questions that was asked?
Sure.
It was asked if we can offer some tips on how to determine the appropriate spatial resolution of data collection for a given site. I think Trevor answered it very well by saying there's no hard and fast plan. It's really an iterative process. And when he says that it has to be flexible and adaptive, that's your work plan. It really has to be as flexible as you can make it within the constraints of reality. So this is where your initial assessment of the site, looking for existing data, can really help you. If you have an old site where a lot of work's been done in the past, this can really help guide you. You can also start picking tools which will help focus your focus your testing, maybe looking at soil gas if you think you have a VOC spill or if it's a coal tar, that'll tell you a different way to look. And again, just get, make sure it's adaptive, and make sure you also look at soil and soil concentration, soil chemistry, other than just groundwater, because that was another mistake from the past, looking at just the groundwater data. So, and then every day, what we like to do, if we can do this, is have a meeting at the end of the day or in the morning to go over the recent data and see what we need to do next to change it. Hope that helps a little bit.
Thank you. Another question has come in asking for the link to the toolbox. So that is available in the middle right in the related links. That last item is tool selection Excel file. So if you don't see that, you may need to scroll down in that box so you can see that. And again, to access these related links through our Adobe Connect room, you select the name of the link, tool selection Excel file, and then you look down a bit, select browse to, and that's going to open the link in a new window. We've also heard that some people are having a little bit of trouble with the Excel file. One reminder is to be sure that to enable the macros as you go into that file. And if you still continue to have problems, let us know. Email us at training@itrcweb.org. We're looking into some other problems, and let us know if you're someone who's having the trouble. Perhaps tell us what version of Excel you're using so that we can help troubleshoot any problems that you're having with that Excel tool selection file. We hope that it is something that you're able to use after today's training class.
Yeah, another thing with that is make sure you've maximized the when you want to use this file, make sure you make sure you're on the internet, you're into the document, maximize it so everything's available. And then you may when you go through your filtering, you may have to restart completely new again because sometimes it'll get stuck. We're still trying to work on getting some of the bugs out of the tool sheet. I think it was a lot more complicated than we expected, but again, make sure you're maximized and may have to start again from scratch each time, but you really can't use it just by itself, especially if you want to use the links. I'm thinking that's what I'm thinking about by maximizing your document on the web, because to click on those and get the links, you have to have that to work.
And to access a document, that's our first related link. So again, select the name and then look down a bit, select Browse To. Also, on slide 111, if you go to our links to additional resources, you can download the presentation that you've seen during today's training class. We also include links to the ITRC guidance document that's the basis of today's training class, as well as links to other related ITRC documents. We've discussed several during today's training class, and we've pulled those together on that additional resources page. Do you have any questions from the phone line audience? We don't have any additional questions coming in online, so we'll go ahead and wrap up a little bit early today. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us today. If you have questions that weren't addressed or if a question occurs to you after today's training, you're welcome to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and I'll follow up with the trainers to get an answer for you. Please fill out the feedback form. We really do use the information and appreciate you taking just a few minutes now to give us your feedback. More information about ITRC is available on the website, www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.